In 1054, the Patriarch of Constantinople and the Pope excommunicated each other. That was the end of holiness for both churches. After that, they became instruments of Satan. Oh, I'm convinced of it. Joseph Herodie. On the narrow trails in the back roads, across the bogs and through dank tree-filled hills, twisting and turning over the heights, sometimes camping, cold, sometimes snug in abandoned cottages, Herodie led his party toward Dublin. They were 18 days reaching the Wicklow foothills, another 9 days circling around to come in from the northeast where they were not expected, and hardly a soul to be seen in the entire passage. To John the trip became a constant, careful sparring with Herodie. The most casual conversation could be dangerous. One afternoon they had passed a leaning signboard with one word on it, Garrettstown. It had been cold, with a wet wind whipping over the hills, and John had longed for something warmer than the sweater. "There's things done for no reason in this land," Herodie said suddenly, glancing sidelong at John. Both of them were heavily whiskered now, John's bald head a veined contrast. "What things?" John asked. "Like slaughterin' the hounds of the Kildare hunt. It was a mean thing, taking out on dumb animals the misery caused by irresponsible humans." Father Michael spoke from behind them. "The hunt was an English thing." "I was there," Herodie said. "And maybe there was a reason, as you say, priest. Provocation. The hunt crowd not understanding how easy it is to expose the devil in your neighbour." John nodded, submitting to an urge to prod at Herodie. "The way someone provoked O'Neill?" Herodie did not rise to this bait, but he walked silently for a time. Father Michael moved up beside them as they came out onto a narrow farm road of unpaved dirt. The boy could be heard trailing along behind.
"I've thought the same thing," Father Michael said.
He looked full at John with an expression of amazement on his long face.
"The foolishness of people is beyond understanding."
"Like wanting to resume the Dublin horse show?"
Herodie asked, his voice filled with slyness. He too looked at John, the men walking along, one on each side of John, both looking at him.
"That was trying to bring back the good things," Father Michael said, but he kept his attention on John.
"Business as usual," Herodie said, looking ahead. "As though nothing had happened to make it obscene. Tell us about it, Father. You was there." They plodded along in silence for almost 50 paces before Father Michael responded. In that time, he took his gaze off John and stared at the ground in front of him.
"It was raining a bit," Father Michael said. "We came on it after the mob had mostly gone. I saw some of the last of them coming away. Carrying boots, some of them were, and bits of clothing. I saw one man with a fine coat over one arm and bloody jodhpurs over the other. A great grin on his face."
Father Michael's voice was low and remote, as though he recounted something seen in a foreign land, a wonder from some heathen place and not an event from civilized Ireland. The four walkers were in a dip in the road now, a short bridge visible at the bottom, and a boggy stream winding its way through reeds under the bridge.
"That mob, they didn't seem ashamed of what they'd done," Father Michael said.
"Ah," Herodie said, "there's anger here just waiting for something to strike."
"There was bodies all over the grounds," Father Michael said. "Men, dead horses, gore. No way to tell Catholic from another. They'd taken away all the crosses for their medal. Not even a ring left. Fingers cut off to get them. I knelt in the mud and prayed."
"But who did it?" John asked.
"A mob," Herodie said.
John looked at Father Michael, fascinated. He pictured the priest coming on that scene, staring down at bodies of horse-show officials and audience. Father Michael's simple words conjured a vision.
"They even took most of the boots and stockings," Father Michael said. boots and stockings.
Why did they do that?
The vision of bare feet outstretched in that muddy carnage like a final gesture of lost humanity stirred John oddly. He felt deeply moved, far beyond the brutal facts being recounted in Father Michael's dull voice. Something besides life had gone out of Ireland with those deaths, John thought. He even felt an absence of glee from O'Neill within. Interest, yes. Fascinated interest. But no particular joy. Perhaps it was satisfaction O'Neill within felt. A feeling of contentment.
John realized then that there was a deep and telling difference between happiness and contentment. O'Neill within might be content with what had been wrought, even while it brought him no happiness.
"How do you feel about this, John?"
Herity asked. "It brings me no joy," John said.
"A black day," Father Michael said.
"Would you listen to him now?" Herity asked. "The only Catholics there was the hustlers and the grooms, the hard-working folk. A pack of Protestant landlords answered for their misdeeds, and the priest is upset."
Father Michael spoke more strongly.
"They were murdered. Slaughtered like animals. With knives, clubs, pitchforks, and bare hands. There wasn't a shot fired."
Herity looked at John. "Does this give you any idea at all? At all? What might happen? Should the madman O'Neill appear in our midst?"
John sensed O'Neill within, silently watchful. "All those deaths and no good reason," Herity said.
"Oh, there was a reason, but I'll agree with the priest that it was better not done."
Herity leaned across John to address Father Michael.
"But you were fascinated by all that death, weren't you, priest? A good reason to pray with your knees in the mud."
Father Michael plodded along with his gaze directed downward. He shuddered. John glanced at the priest, sensing the darting accuracy of Herity's remark. Yes, Father Michael shared his church's love-hate relationship with death. It was his source of power as a priest, but the man within could not be denied either. No more could O'Neill within. Death was the ultimate failure, the human weakness that went beyond illusion into illusion, that invention whose absolute sway could not be avoided. Herity saw concealed things.
"It's educational, it is," Herity said, "listening to the voice of a man when you cannot see his face."
Again he leaned forward to peer across John at the priest.
"I listen to you, Michael Flannery. You telling about that slaughter and not a sign to say you see at last why I spit on your church."
Father Michael did not respond. Herity grinned and returned his attention to the road ahead of them. The boy could be heard behind them throwing a rock into the bushes. They had topped the rise beyond the stream now and looked down a long hill where the road entered a thick barrier of evergreens.
"You see, priest," Herity said, "what is most difficult is to be abandoned by God. He left me. I did not leave him. They have taken away my religion."
Father Michael's eyes glistened with unshed tears. He thought, "Oh yes, Joseph Herity, I understand about that. I know all the psychological things they taught in the seminary. You would say the church is my substitute for sex. It's the love I could never find from a woman. Oh yes, I understand you. It's a new church you think we have, and not a woman for any of us."
Without knowing why, Father Michael felt strength entering him from Herity's words.
"Thank you, Joseph," he said.
"Thank me? What is this you're saying?"
Herity's voice was filled with outrage.
"Oh, I thought I was alone," Father Michael said. "I see that I'm not. For that, I thank you."
"Crab the man," Herity said. He fell into angry silence, replaced presently by a sly smile.
"You're confused, priest," he said. "There's none of us together."
John saw the look of amusement on Herity's face.
and Father Michael.
Confusion?
Herodi obviously took malicious enjoyment from another's confusion. Did he enjoy Ireland's confusion as well? No. That went contrary to Herodi's cause. The plague had upset the untouchable. Recognizing this, John realized with an abrupt shock of awareness that he had the key to Herodi, the thing that would undo the man, destroy his belief in his cause. But that was the very thing Herodi was trying to do to Father Michael. How could that be a weakness in Herodi and, yes, a strength in Father Michael?
What are your politics, Joseph? John asked.
Me politics? He grinned. I'm a liberal, I am. Always was.
He's a godless Marxist, Father Michael said.
Better than a godless priest, Herodi said.
John, do you know about the war of indefinite duration? Father Michael asked.
Close your flytrap, Michael Flannery, Herodi said, his voice even and venomous.
Never heard of it, John said. He sensed a poised stillness in Herodi.
That's the provost, Father Michael said.
He returned Herodi's black look with a smile.
Prevent any settlement. Kill the ones who'd compromise. Terrify the peacemakers. Prevent any solution. Give the people only war and violence, death and terror until they're so sick of it they'll accept anything in its place, even the godless Marxists.
You'll recall, Herodi said, that this priest mourned the prod landlords at the Dublin horse show.
The greedy capitalists.
They were greedy, right enough, Father Michael said.
I'll grant you that.
It's greed that drives the conservatives. But it's envy driving the liberals. And these Marxists.
He hooked a disdainful thumb at Herodi.
All they want is to sit in the seats of the mighty and lord it over everyone else. The intellectual aristocrats.
John heard a new strength in Father Michael's voice. The man apparently possessed powerful roots, and he had found them. He might be beset by doubts, but the strength he gained by struggling against his doubts accumulated. It grew day by day.
Now that I know how to pray for you, I shall pray for you, Joseph Herodi, Father Michael said.
John looked from one man to the other, sensing the deep currents between them. A malicious grin came over Herodi's mouth, but did not touch his eyes. He patted the machine gun on its strap at his chest.
Here's me soul, priest. Pray for this.
There's a demon loose in our land, Joseph, Father Michael said.
Herodi sobered. A wild look entered his eyes.
A demon, is it?
A demon,
Father Michael repeated. Still with that sober look, Herodi said,
Mercy secure ye all, and keep the goblin from ye while ye sleep.
His wolfish grin returned. The words are Robert Eric, priest.
You see the advantages in a classical education?
There's advantages in fearing God as well.
Father Michael's voice was calm and assured.
Some things we fear because they're real, priest, Herodi said. Some things are only illusion. Like your precious church and its pretty words and its fancy rituals. A poor substitute for living as a free man.
Are you a free man, Joseph?
Father Michael asked. Herodi paled and looked away. He spoke with his gaze directed at the side of the road.
I'm freer than any man present.
He whipped his gaze around to focus on John.
I'm freer than this John Garrick O'Donnell and him with something terrible hidden deep inside him.
John's mouth clamped shut. He felt a jaw muscle twitching.
Damn the man. There's illusions, and there's illusions, Herodi said.
Sure, and we all know it.
John kept his attention directed straight ahead. He could feel the pressure of attention upon him from both sides. Was it only illusion, after all?
A substitute for life,
Herodi said, a terrible pressure in his voice.
John looked to his right, seeking help from Father Michael, but the priest kept his gaze on the road at his feet.
"Do you find your illusions comforting, John?"
Herity asked.
"As comforting as the illusions of the priest there?"
John felt the stirring of O'Neill within.
"How did I come by this thing?" he wondered.
"Was there ever a place where it could be identified?" He felt that the acquisition had been slow. Like a growth, perhaps, or a new skin. Steadily constant, casually demanding, but never importunate. It was the self intrinsic, and the memories were real.
Father Michael wrestled with his own demon, feeling it aroused by Herity's words, even though he knew these words were not directed at him, but at the poor soul walking with them. Was it truly the madman in this quiet American?
How do we come by what we are? Father Michael wondered. He remembered a basement room in his village church. Ballinspittle, a name the Yankees made joke of, but it was his own. The church with its plaster neatly applied by a local artisan as a service to God. Remembering gave Father Michael an anchor in his past. Clean and white the plaster had been, framed pictures spaced along it. Sacred Heart of Jesus, Holy Mary, Mother of God. A whole row of popes, a blessed medal draped on its chain across red velvet, all in a heavy frame under glass, and with a brass plate underneath telling whoever looked that it had been blessed by Pope Pius himself. There were benches in the basement room. Father Michael remembered sitting on a bench, his legs too short to reach the floor, his eyes fixed on a plaque nailed to the back of the bench ahead of him. To the sacred memory of Aileen Matthews, 1896-1931, presented by her loving children. How remote it all felt now. John felt tormented by the silence of his companions, and by their very presence. He wanted to run away, to dash off into the fields and bury his face in concealing grass, never to rise again. But Herity was too dangerous. Anything I do, he can see it, and see through it. Well, perhaps I shouldn't pry, Herity said, his voice light. That being a commandment of these times.
John's throat felt parched. He longed for a drink of water, or something stronger. What was it Herity carried in those small plastic jugs? He often had the smell of whiskey on his breath, but he wasn't sharing it. John looked off to his right. A hill there, the barren silhouette of a dead pine on its flank with ivy climbing the wooden corpse. The ivy was a winding cloth on the stark witch shape.
"We'll be stopping here," Herity said.
Obediently, they all stopped. Herity was looking off to his left, a tiny cottage there only a few meters from the dirt road. There was a plaque on its closed door. Donkey House. A small stream ran past the door, no more than a handspan wide, flowing silently over black rocks.
"Donkey House," Herity said. He shifted his gun to the ready. "Now wouldn't that be a fine place for the likes of us to stop and rest? It being unoccupied, of course."
He hopped the stream and peered in a corner of the one window beside the door.
"Dirty, but empty," he said. "And doesn't that sound like a fitting description of some who are known to us?
The mothers are gone, for Christ's sakes. Like the man says, the primal center of the family is no more in those regions. The keepers of the faith are gone. It's the end of the Romish church in Ireland and a hell of a lot of other places. Let 'em die off on their own, I say." Charles Turkwood.
Kate had developed a mental game of her own for the times when she felt that Stephen wanted no more of her, those times when his attention submerged into his books and he refused to answer her simplest question. She played it now, in the morning quiet of their confinement, her eyes closed, her feet tucked under her on the chair. Stephen could be heard where he sat across from her, the pages of his book turning with an irritating rhythm. Only a few minutes ago she had said,
"My back aches, Stephen. Will you rub it, please?"
Stephen had grunted. She hated that grunt. It said, "Don't bother me. get away from me. And she had no place to go except into her own mind. It was a fascinating, imaginative game. What I will do when we have come through these times.
Safely into her own imagination, she could live without any doubts of her personal survival. The rest of the world might be reduced to rubble. One hand would emerge from that rubble, pulling a survivor out of the ruin. She would be that survivor. They were changing the guard and servicing one of the compressors outside the pressure chamber. Metal clanged occasionally on metal. Voices exchanged bits of trivia. She tuned it all out of her awareness, sinking deeper and deeper into the world of her own creation.
"I will wear fine jewels," she thought.
This avenue did not attract her now. She had played the possession game too many times. Jewels, designer clothing, a beautiful home. Sooner or later, the retreat into future possessions found her in her own dream home, but that was frustrating. She could not truly fill out such a home, not even furnish it in the way she knew it might be furnished. Her image of a perfect home had been fixed on Peard's cottage at the lake. She knew there were grander homes. Films had let her glimpse mansions. She had visited the magnificent residence of a retired doctor near Cork once, going there with her mother to visit the housekeeper, who was an old friend. The friend had led them through quiet, unoccupied rooms. A library, a music room, a solarium, a great cavern of a kitchen with a massive peat stove. The peat stove definitely would not do. It would have to be gas, just as in Peard's cottage. Poof! There went the entire dream fabric. She did not have enough experience upon which to construct an acceptable fantasy. Whatever. It would be a home with Stephen, of course, because they were bound together now as surely as man and woman could be united.
"Our children will be with us," she thought. "And Stephen will..."
No, she did not want that dream. Stephen was always there somewhere, and she was angry with him now.
He might die, though.
That shocked her, but she held to it, feeling guilty and suddenly without roots. Stephen could be killed, protecting her. She did not doubt that Stephen would give his life for her. How sad that would be, living with the memory of such a sacrifice.
"I would be a lonely widow."
Nagging awareness interrupted.
"A lonely widow? In a world with thousands of men for every woman?"
It was an exciting thought, making her gasp. Sad it might be, but the power in it. Who might she take as a second husband? Somebody important, certainly. She knew herself as no raving beauty, but still. Abruptly, with part of her mind, she knew this was not merely idle speculation. This fantasy had touched something live and real. It was almost palpable, and she found this both magnetic and terrifying. She knew then that she had opened up something more than just a dream. This was a channel where fantasy might educate, or at least prepare her against strange possibilities. Kate focused hard on that external world, then, that place outside the pressure chamber where new relationships were developing. It was a crucible out there with agony and wrenching loss. Any fantasy she attempted from now on would have to consider the strange realities that she saw only as reflections from the words of the guards and the images on the telly.
"When they have found a cure, I will step out into that world," she thought.
This was a profoundly disturbing realization, and she felt angry at her own fantasies for leading her into such a predicament. She still did not doubt that she would survive. Fantasy protected her there. But right at the edge of her dreams there lay goblin actualities, which leered at her. Frantic, she grasped for a protective dream.
An island. That was it.
She and Stephen would find their own island and...
"What are you thinking, Kate? Your face is all screwed up as though you'd swallowed something bitter."
Stephen's voice intruded at the moment she found her fantasy breaking on more impossibilities.
"What island?"
How would they get to it? She found herself thankful for the interruption. Opening her eyes, she saw that Stephen had put down his book and was preparing to bake bread. Odd how he liked to do that, a bit of domesticity in him that she had never suspected. All the ingredients came in sterilized cans, though, and he had fastened on this as a way to add interest to their lives.
"I was wondering what'll become of us when we get out of here," she said.
He turned a wide grin of pleasure toward her. "There's my girl. Never doubt for a minute that we'll make it, darling."
"Will we, Stephen?"
Without her dreams, she found herself plunged back into a world beset by doubts.
"Please, Stephen, tell me something reassuring."
"We're perfectly safe here," he said. But there was a ring of insincerity in his voice that she had come to recognize immediately.
"Oh, Stephen."
Kate dissolved into sobs, and all thought of bread-baking was gone for the moment. His hands still dusted with flour, Stephen came across the room and knelt beside her, holding her tightly around the waist and his cheek pressed against her abdomen.
"I'll protect you, Katie," he whispered.
She clutched at him, holding his head against her.
"Oh, God! He might die trying to protect me."
The hand that signed the paper fell the city. 5 sovereign fingers taxed the breath. Doubled the globe of dead and halved a country. These 5 kings did a king to death. Dylan Thomas. Herity followed an even more circumspect route as they neared Dublin, leading his party in across the pasture lands to the northwest of the city, and avoiding the travelled ways to the interior where, it was said, bands of land pirates still lurked. John remained a mystery to him, but there was no doubt in Herity's mind that the man concealed something dark. He might be the madman. Then again, he might only be another lost one with his own sins on his mind, his own griefs and reasons for coming here. He might even be sincerely desirous of helping Ireland in its hour of testing. As he marched across the fields toward Dublin, Herity prodded and listened to every word John uttered. He was maddening. How could this be the madman? There was emotional betrayal in him, but betrayal of what? Father Michael remarked on the absence of cattle as they neared the city. "Men still eat," Herity said. "But they leave a lot for the birds," Father Michael said. The boy took on an intense look of concern as Father Michael mentioned the birds. An ancient stone ruin stood off to the side of their track, rooks soaring around it. Beyond it they could see the hills to the south of the city. Barren trees devoid of all green fanged the heights. Somewhere over there lay Tara, Herity knew. There where kings had lived, not even cattle grazed now. "Isn't it strange," Father Michael mused, "so many of the ancient lyrics mentioning the blackbirds?" He stared at the birds wheeling over the ruin. John also watched the flock, thinking how those particular birds haunted this landscape, realizing that this must always have been the case. He said as much, noting how sharply the boy looked from one speaker to another when the birds were mentioned. Herity kept his gaze roving over the landscape around them, a mounting tension in him. Green copses off there and burned houses, the meadows like moats with the weed-grown lanes through them. A burned patch in a meadow off to the left showed ugly mounds in it, suggestive shapes drawn there in charcoal and not yet washed away by the rains. Bodies? A dark line of rain could be seen sweeping across the fields and copses, black as the wings of the soaring birds. Seeing undamaged buildings ahead, they hurried to beat the storm. Their lane came out on a narrow paved road with an intact shed beside it, glass on the ends of the shed, a long bench at the rear, an empty wooden pocket there for timetables on a no longer existent bus line. The squall swept overhead as they reached this shelter, and they were only dampened by it as they huddled in the rear. Rain pelted the roof and bounced off the macadam, bright pellets of water beating all around. The temperature dropped sharply. As quickly as it had come, the storm passed.
It left long lanes of blue in the sky. The hills to the south stood out clearly in the rain-washed air, ridges lighted by the lowering sun. Green there, with patches of yellow firs, the trees clumped along the ridges like spears planted there by the ancient kings who had ruled from that place. John stepped out of the shelter and stared around him. There was an emerald brilliance to the land, a beauty that he thought had been near enough to this for eons. Something to ignite in the human breast a love of the earth beneath the feet. He felt that it was a thing deeper than patriotism, because it infected Gaelic descendants who had never seen this land. People caught up in that kind of love identified with it. They became bound to it in a way that could make them happy, if they could only go into a grave covered by such beauty. Was it possible, John wondered, to love a country without caring very much for the people who put their mark on it? Possession might not be 9 points of that law after all. When you considered it carefully, possession was transient, no more than the right to carve your initials in a length of cliffside, or to build a wall that eventually would melt back into the earth. Harrity came around from behind the shed, zipping up his fly. "Let's be moving along. We'll not be in Dublin by nightfall, but there's shelter ahead and a bit more civilization. We're inside the Dublin Pale here at last." He strode off. John fell into step beside him. Father Michael and the boy brought up the rear. "Despite what Joseph says, don't expect civilization here," Father Michael said. "This is a brutal place, John. It may be that the centres of government were always this way, and now we've merely pulled off the mask, exposing the truth of the matter." "Brutal?" John asked. "There's stories of torture and madness and proof enough to confirm them." "Then why are we going here? Why aren't we going directly to the lab at Killaloe?" Father Michael nodded toward Harrity's back. "Orders." John felt his palms wet against the machine gun, which hung from its neck strap next to his chest. One little flick of a finger to remove the safety the way Harrity had showed him. He could run off by himself and find his own way to Killaloe. Or could he? 3 bodies to dispose of, and no telling who might come to investigate the shooting. He glanced at the boy. Could I do it? He felt his fingers relaxing from the gun's hard metal, and that was answer enough. Something had changed among the 4 of them here on this road. O'Neill's revenge had been accomplished upon these people. John knew then he could not bring his companions more agony. "What do you mean, torture?" he asked. "I'll not speak more of it," Father Michael said. "There's things bad enough in this poor land." He shook his head. The road led into a tall stand of evergreens, and they were almost into the trees now. John glimpsed buildings off to the right through the dark trunks of the evergreens, white stone and black roof. It was a large building with several chimneys. Smoke drew vertical lines from 2 of the chimneys. Harrity whistled as he walked. Abruptly he stopped whistling and held up a hand for them to stop. He cocked his head, listening. John grew aware of singing, the sound of choristers in the distance toward the building. It was a lovely sound of harmony, reminding him of holidays. His memories began to play. Grandpa Jack, firelight and stories, music from the radio. The singing grew louder, extinguishing the memories. Illusion vanished as he recognized the chorister's words. "Listen to the little bastards, will you?" Harrity exulted. "Listen to him, Michael Flannery!" The sweet young voices sang with inescapable clarity. "Feckin' Mary we adore, feckin' Mary, Jesus whore, and when we all ejaculate, that is why we masturbate." Father Michael clapped his hands over his ears and failed to note that the singing stopped. Now there was only a grunting chant from off in the trees, a Gregorian parody. "Hut, hut, 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 hut." Harrity threw back his head in laughter. "Now there's memorable blasphemy for you. There's blasphemy to conjure with, priest." He grabbed Father Michael's right arm and pulled it away from the ear.
Ah, now, Michael, I wish I'd thought of that little song. Somewhere you still have a conscience, Joseph, Father Michael said. I shall find it yet, though it lie beyond the bottomless pit. Conscience, you say, Herity blared. Is that your church's old guilt game, then? Whenever will you learn?
He turned and strode off down the road, the others close behind.
Father Michael spoke in a conversational voice.
Why do you speak of guilt, Joseph? Is it something on that conscience you profess not to have?
It was clear to John that the priest was maintaining better control. Herity's anger mounted with every step. His knuckles were white on the stock of the machine gun. John wondered if the man might turn that weapon against the priest.
Why will you not answer me, Joseph? Father Michael asked. It's you that has the guilt, Herity raged. You and your church.
You keep harping on the church, Father Michael said, his tone reasonable.
If one person says you're guilty, yourself saying it to yourself, that's a sore problem, Joseph. But the collective guilt of a whole people, that's another matter. You're a dirty, lying priest. Hearing you rant has brought me to some hard thinking, Joseph.
Father Michael quickened his pace until he walked beside Herity.
It occurs to me, it does, that it's hard for a collectivity of people to accept the awakening of its conscience.
Herity stopped in the centre of the road, forcing Father Michael to stop also. John and the boy halted a few paces back and watched the antagonists. Herity regarded Father Michael with a silent scowl, his forehead creased in thought.
The church could administer to the individual, Father Michael said, but not to the people. That was our failure. Where is a people's conscience?
A look of bland superiority erased the scowl from Herity's face. He stared at the priest.
Has the mad priest finally come around to sanity? Do you see at last the world you've made? All I'm saying is that it's hard for people to feel guilty together, Father Michael said. Is that all of it?
There was glee in Herity's voice. Father Michael turned and looked back the way they had come, staring past John and the boy at the road climbing out of the trees toward the meadows.
No, Joseph, that's not all of it. Before the people will accept guilt, they'll do terrible things together. Batter the bloodbath, kill the innocents, ignite the war, lynch and murder.
John felt the priest's words like a physical lash. What was this? What had Father Michael said to produce such feelings? John knew his face must appear frozen. He could not sense O'Neill within anywhere. He had been left alone to face this thing, whatever it was. He felt shattered, broken away from essential ground.
So you're sorry for all the pain you've spread? Herity asked.
John felt the question. He thought it had been asked of him directly, although it was obvious the words were directed at the priest.
Sorry.
Father Michael looked squarely at Herity, forcing the man to meet his gaze. It was as though Father Michael saw Herity clearly for the first time.
Why should I be sorry?
Blather, Herity sneered. His voice sounded weak, though.
Father Michael says this, Father Michael says that. But Father Michael is a notorious liar, trained in it by the Jesuits.
Joseph, Joseph, Father Michael said, pity in his tone.
John Donne's bell can toll for the one, but not for the many. I shall pray for your individual soul, Joseph, and for the soul of any individual I can identify. As to the many, I see that I must think on it.
Think on it?
Is that all you can do, you silly old fool?
Herity turned his glare on John.
And what are you staring at, Yank?
The boy stepped clear of John's side, stopping a pace away. John tried to swallow in a dry throat. He knew his inner turmoil must be transparent. Herity appeared not to notice.
Well, Yank?
I...
I was listening.
And what did you hear?
You there with your ears stuck out like the wings on a bird. And John cleared his throat. An intellectual argument.
You're another liar,
Herity said. Now, Joseph, Father Michael said, his voice mild. I think John was merely mistaken.
Stay out of this, priest. This is between the Yank and me.
No, Joseph, it is not. I aroused your anger and you could not best me. Now you attack our guest. Herity turned a look of disdain on Father Michael.
Could not best you?
It was not an intellectual argument, the priest said. On that I do agree. He looked benignly at John.
We Irish don't really like an intellectual argument.
Herity opened his mouth and closed it without speaking.
I know we often say an intellectual argument is the darling of our desires, Father Michael said. But that's not true. We much prefer passions. We like to fan the burning in the guts. We like to parade our agonies.
Is this you speaking, Michael Flannery?
Herity asked, wonder in his voice.
That it is. And I'm saying it's only a short step across the pits of hell. One step to take us into the deliberate creation of agonies to parade.
Can I believe my ears?
Herity asked the air. He leaned toward the priest, peering up under the hat-brim as though trying to determine if this were truly Father Michael.
Can it be yourself saying such wonderful things?
A wry chuckle shook the priest.
We've had the time for a spell of thinking on this tramp, haven't we, Joseph?
Herity did not answer. Father Michael turned his attention to John, and John wondered at the pain of that gaze. So mild and so accusing, he felt it like the cutting of a knife in his chest.
The most intellectual pursuit of the Irish, Father Michael said, is the pursuit of the sardonic.
He glanced at Herity, and Herity recoiled, sniffing and rubbing at his nose.
A pity. We always stop short of laughing at ourselves. A thing we should be doing when we face up to our more bitter truths.
You wouldn't know a truth if it kicked you in the balls, and you not having a one, Herity accused.
Then all is peace and tranquillity in our poor land, is it? Father Michael asked. Sweet agreement everywhere, as it's always been.
Whatever hurt we've had, Herity said, comes from our enduring devotion to the superstitions of the church, and it sapping the strength out of us for all these centuries. Father Michael sighed.
Joseph, I think your worst vice may be that you haven't it in you to be magnanimous.
It's God's own truth you've stumbled onto there, Herity said.
Magnanimity isn't the most celebrated Irish virtue, as some poor bastard is supposed to have said.
I'll own to it, Michael Flannery, because I know we must hold to our hates. Where else do we find the strength to go on?
Thank you, Joseph, Father Michael said. There's hope for you yet, and I'll continue my prayers. The priest turned on a heel and strode off down the road. John realized in that moment that something in the argument had completely restored Father Michael's faith. What had Herity said to accomplish that? John stared at the priest's receding back. So strongly he walked, so firm and assured. Herity, too, stared after Father Michael.
There you go, priest, Herity called. Running away?
He looked at John.
See how he runs?
But the weakness in Herity's voice was an admission of defeat. He had tried his best to kill the priest's faith, and he had failed. The boy ran after Father Michael. Catching up to the priest, he grasped the man's hand.
No hope for either of them,
Herity said.
Well, come along, John. My friends have been watching us.
He gestured with the machine gun as the two men came out of the woods ahead of Father Michael and the boy.
And here they are now.
Herity reached across to John as they began walking and slipped the machine gun and its sling over John's head.
They might not understand. Will you be passing me the little five-shooter as well?
John stared ahead as though in a dream, obeying Herity without really feeling the pistol as he rid himself of it. One of the two men coming toward them was Kevin O'Donnell, still wearing the Aussie hat he'd worn that night on the pier at Kinsale.